at the next regularly scheduled election.
If you're a student in high school and you have policies actively targeting you and your humanity, that's your entire high school career. You don't get to wait another 4 years and say, don't worry.
Now, conservatives see this differently. They say this is simply a case of powerful unions who did not like recent election results, didn't like who ended up on the school board, and are now trying to engineer a different result in special elections.
So, Guy, what are your big takeaways from your reporting on this?
Well, I think this, you know, organized pushback that we're seeing to these conservative board members was not necessarily a given a year ago. There were a lot of questions about how opponents of these board members were going to respond. We'll have to see how the results shake out in Temecula this week and in Sonoma next month. But I do think regardless of the results, it's clear that opponents of these conservative board members have had a bit of a wake-up call. You know, they're now vowing to take these school board seats more seriously, contest them in general elections. And oh, by the way, Republican officials I talked to said they're just as committed to winning these seats in the future. So I think you can expect this fight to continue, perhaps escalate as we move towards November.
That's KQED politics correspondent Guy Marzorati. Guy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Madi.
Support for the California Report comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at Irvine.org. Stanford Medicine, comprising its School of Medicine and Adult and Children's Health Systems, working together to advance knowledge and improve lives. StanfordMedicine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy includes Schmidt Ocean Institute, advancing the frontiers of ocean science, exploration, and discovery, on the web at SchmidtOcean.org.
And that's the California Report for Monday, June 3rd. We're a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Madi Bolaños. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
You'll get a new hour of Morning Edition and the latest KQED news all ahead in just a minute. Mel Baker checks in now with your traffic at 6:59 on this Monday.
In Nevada, 101 southbound between Petaluma Boulevard South down to Atherton Avenue, that's stop and go. It is stop and go on 121 westbound between Highway 29 and Old Napa Road in Napa. Slows again from Shellville out to Arnold Drive. 37 westbound from Wilson to the Lane merge, nearly stopped traffic. It's heavy there, but that's pretty standard for a normal weekday commute. Slow and stretches there from to there to the raceway. Mel Baker, 4KQED.
Traffic support from Murphy McKenna Construction, and support for KQED comes from SF MoMA, welcoming music lovers to celebrate 100 years of music and design. Art of Noise features over 800 works from rock posters to hi-fi listening experiences. On view now, more at sfmoma.org. I'm Dave Freeman. It's 7 o'clock.
Good morning. In this election year, polling shows health care ranks near the top of voters' concerns.
I feel like access to good, affordable health care should be a human right.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, it's about to get hot. A heat wave is heading to the Bay Area. I'm Brian Watt.
For Americans with lower incomes, health insurance can be unaffordable. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Medicaid can be a lifeline. I traveled to Georgia to find out why the state has not expanded the program despite the federal government offering to pay for it. The stakes are huge.
I've talked with Georgians who have died because they couldn't get Medicaid until after they had stage 4 cancer.
We explore Medicaid expansion and other healthcare stories all week as we continue our series, We the Voters, the Left, the Right, the Disillusioned. News is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Corva Coleman. President Biden's son, Hunter, has arrived at a federal courthouse in Delaware. First Lady Jill Biden is there, too. Jury selection starts today for Hunter Biden's trial on federal firearm charges. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports he's accused of lying about his illegal drug use when he bought a gun 6 years ago.
The case centers around a Colt revolver Hunter Biden purchased in October of 2018. Prosecutors say Biden lied about his illegal drug use on a background check form he filled out when buying the gun. He faces two counts of making false statements and one count of illegal possession of a firearm by a drug user or addict. The case was brought by Justice Department Special Counsel David Weiss. The trial in Delaware comes less than a year after a tentative deal with prosecutors that would have allowed Biden to avoid trial entirely fell apart. Weiss also has separately brought tax charges against the president's son in a case in California. That's scheduled for trial in September. But first, there's a gun case in Delaware, which is expected to last up to 2 weeks. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
A Republican-led House panel is going to question Dr. Anthony Fauci this hour. Some lawmakers are expected to grill him on his handling of the federal government's pandemic response. Republicans are also questioning theories about the origin of the coronavirus. The Biden administration is pressuring Israel and Hamas to agree to a ceasefire proposal. Biden revealed the plan last week. It had been offered by Israel behind closed doors. Hamas says it's ready to deal constructively with the plan. NPR's General Estrin says Israel's public stance is not clear.
The problem here with this deal is political. On the one hand, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, has endorsed this plan privately. That's what an Israeli official tells me. But Netanyahu cannot come out and say it outright because the far-right flank in his government is threatening to resign over this proposal because they say it would keep Hamas intact. And if the far-right does resign, Netanyahu simply won't have a government anymore, and that could spell the end of his political career.
NPR's Daniel Estrin reporting. Stocks opened mixed this morning as investors wait for news on the U.S. job market. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped more than 80 points in early trading.
The Labor Department is set to report tomorrow on job turnover during the month of April. Then on Friday, we'll get a tally of the number of jobs that employers added in May. The U.S. labor market remains historically strong. The unemployment rate has been under 4% for 27 months in a row. OPEC and its allies are trying to prop up crude oil prices by maintaining production cuts into the new year. Oil prices rose slightly after the cartel's announcement, but retail gasoline prices in the U.S. continue to slide, down 6 cents a gallon for regular in the last week. Stock in Boston Beer Company has lost some foam after a would-be Japanese suitor denied it's in talks to buy the brewery. The maker of Sam Adams beer saw its shares soar last week when news of the potential sale first broke. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. San Francisco transit workers have rejected a tentative labor deal with the city. The Chronicle reports that a large majority of a transport workers union local chapter voted last week against a deal offered by the city. The union represents light rail and bus operators, fare inspectors, and mechanics, among others. It's unclear why the deal was rejected. The union's current contract expires at the end of this month. TWU and San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency officials have yet to comment. A major effort decades in the making to create an African-American cultural center in the South Bay is getting a boost of federal funding. KQED's Joseph Jiha has the story.
The $4.8 million federal grant is the largest single contribution to the long-envisioned African-American Cultural Center of Silicon Valley, according to project leaders. The money was secured with the help of Silicon Valley Congressman Ro Khanna. In all, $30 million has been raised to date, and the project is estimated to cost $200 million. The San Jose-based center is planned to include a new location of the African American Community Service Agency, a health clinic, housing, and a theater and museum. It's projected to be complete in about 5 years. I'm Joseph Jiha, KQED News.
In sports, the Giants got swept by the Yankees at home. Sunday, New York scored 4 in the ninth, beating San Francisco 7-5. The Giants visit the Diamondbacks this evening. The A's lost in Atlanta 3-1. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support for NPR on Monday comes from Capital One, offering their travel card venture, What's in Your Wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And by the listeners and members of KQED-FM San Francisco and KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento. At 7:06, let's find out about traffic conditions now on the San Mateo Bridge.
92 westbound between Midspan and Mariners Island Boulevard. Already slow traffic on the San Mateo Bridge. No problems on the Dumbarton as of yet. On the Bay Bridge, the backup is to the Maze. And on the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge, it is stop and go all the way from the Richmond Parkway to the tolls. Mel Baker for KQED.
On KQED News at 8:22 on this Monday, the Oakland Ballers' first home game is sold out, which means more than 4,000 people will be showing up in West Oakland. Ahead for you at 8:22, we're going to have a look at what the Ballers are doing to encourage fans not to drive to the game. Join us here on KQED Public Radio. The Bay Area weather forecast, morning clouds today, actually some drizzle forecast right along the water. That all changes tomorrow. That's the coolest spot to be right now along the coast with highs in the 60s to the upper 80s today. Partly to mostly cloudy skies are forecast. Partly cloudy tonight, lows in the 40s and 50s. Then it clears, sunshine tomorrow, warmer temperatures. Look for highs in the 70s to the upper 90s far inland around the Bay Area. For the Sacramento Valley, look for cloudy skies today also. Some gusty winds up to 35, highs 80 to 88. Tomorrow, an excessive heat warning begins at 11 a.m. officially, with tomorrow's high temperatures between 98 and possibly 104 degrees. Sacramento's predicted high today, 86. The time now is 7:07.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Good morning. It's an election year, if you haven't noticed. And one issue we're seeing come up again and again in polls is health care. Everything from the cost of it to how difficult it can be to find it. This week, as part of our We the Voters series, we're going to give the nation's health care system a checkup and tell you how politics affects it.
Today, we're looking at Medicaid. Now, you don't need me to tell you that health insurance is expensive. For people with lower incomes, Medicaid, the joint federal and state insurance program, can be a lifeline. Under the Affordable Care Act, the federal government provides funding to states to expand the program to more people. Most states have chosen to take that money, but 10 have not. Georgia is one of them. When we traveled there recently, we found that decisions leaving some people behind. Amy Wilson is the music director of the Atlanta Philharmonic Orchestra. The musicians are all volunteers, and they're rehearsing a piece by Tchaikovsky in the basement of a church in Decatur. Wilson conducts the orchestra. She stops the group and makes adjustments.
Could you give a little shape in this melody? Bum, ba ba bum, ba ba bum, bum. Please?
Speaking to us before the rehearsal, Wilson told us that this is what she's always wanted to do.
I started singing in the church choir when I was 3. And my mother tells me that I told her when I was 3 years old I wanted to be a conductor.
But now, it's a challenge for her just to hold her baton for the whole rehearsal.
My life was good before brain cancer, and I miss it.
In January 2020, Wilson was diagnosed with a brain tumor. She had surgery to have it removed. Wilson was already receiving some Medicare benefits due to an existing disability. That federal program also insures people over the age of 65. It wasn't enough to cover the care Wilson needed at an area hospital.
So I remember the summer I was doing chemo and radiation, and I would call the financial aid people, and I said to them, I don't know what I can do because I can't afford treatment because I'm not on Medicaid, I'm on Medicare. And they said to me, get the treatment and figure out how to pay for it later. If you don't get the treatment, you're not going to be here, so do it. And so I did, and I've struggled ever since.
So you said you had Medicare, but not Medicaid. Why couldn't you get Medicaid?
I am above the income threshold. Even without my job here, like during the pandemic, I'm still like $30 above the income threshold.
And that $30 means you can't get Medicaid?
It's a yes or no situation. You don't get partial or anything.
$30, wow. That doesn't seem like a lot, right?
Yeah, I wish it was at least prorated or something.
To make matters worse, after finishing treatments for the tumor, Wilson was diagnosed with lymphoma, another type of cancer. Her situation is complex because she's close to being eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. It's similar to a problem many other Georgians face. If the state was to expand Medicaid under the ACA, it would give health insurance to people with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty level. That's about $21,000 a year. KFF is a nonprofit that researches healthcare policy. It estimates that expansion would mean over 350,000 more Georgians with coverage. It's a similar story for the 9 other states that haven't expanded the program, mostly in the South. Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama, South Carolina, Florida, and Texas, along with Wyoming, Wisconsin, and Kansas.
Good morning, everyone.
We wanted to ask Georgia's Governor Brian Kemp why he opposes expanding Medicaid. His office declined an interview, so we went to his budget signing at the state capitol in Atlanta.
We've already made incredible strides in both increasing access but also improving affordability for health insurance.
That's Kemp touting funding to train new doctors, to attract dentists to rural areas, and more. But he did not mention Medicaid or his alternative, a plan he calls Georgia Pathways to Coverage. In a gaggle with reporters after the signing, Kemp was asked if he'd ever support expanding Medicaid.
Well, the plans that we have for our conservative Medicaid expansion is just getting started because the Biden administration has tried to block those efforts.
Governor Kemp thinks what Georgia is doing now is better for people's health and the state's finances.
The advocates for Medicaid expansion always said it'll add 600,000 people to the rolls. Well, right now in Georgia, we've added 713,000 people to the rolls. The majority of those are on private sector health insurance. So expanding Medicaid will take people off of their private sector insurance and put them on the government-run health care. That is going to cost more money in the short term, more money in the long term. So to me, that does not make good budgeting sense to do that.
When he says conservative Medicaid expansion, Kemp is talking about the Pathways program. It provides health insurance to people with incomes of up to 100% of the federal poverty level, fewer than the full Medicaid expansion would cover. It also requires people to work, study, or volunteer for 80 hours a month to get it. We wanted to understand more about all this, so right after the governor left, we talked with a reporter who asked him about it.
I'm Ariel Hart with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
We began talking about Kemp's Pathways program.
It's been up and rolling for almost a year now, and it's got, I think, what everyone would acknowledge is pretty poor enrollment, about 4,000 out of an expected 100,000.
Does his argument that the Biden administration has been trying to block his plan, Pathways, does that hold any water to you?
Well, there's no doubt that the Biden administration blocked the plan for a couple years, and you can argue about whether they did it because it had work requirements and the Biden administration is philosophically opposed to work requirements, or whether indeed it was because the pandemic was ongoing and there was just too much chaos in the Medicaid market and they didn't want Georgia to have that on its plate.
Hart also picked up on Kemp's boast about enrolling over 700,000 Georgians in health plans.
He's fully taking credit for the Affordable Care Act signups for the population between 100% of the federal poverty level and 138% of the poverty level. Every state that does not expand Medicaid, that population, the federal government steps in and says, you don't have affordable coverage, we will allow you to sign up for a private health care plan on the Affordable Care Act exchange. And with Biden administration subsidies, those plans have been basically free.
In other words, the vast majority of those newly insured people got covered under the ACA, a federal program. President Biden has boosted enrollment efforts, funding President Trump cut drastically when he was in office. And that part about people losing private insurance if Medicaid was expanded, Hart says the governor's office now concedes that wouldn't necessarily be the case. The state of Arkansas, for example, built its expansion plan this way.
Arkansas takes the Medicaid money, puts it into the marketplace with the cooperation of the federal government, and puts those people on private ACA plans.
While the Biden administration tried to stop Pathways, Hart says the Trump administration worked closely with the governor's office to develop it. And a Trump victory in November could mean renewed support. Liz Ernst is with Protect Our Care Georgia. The group advocates for more affordable health care.
The legislature clearly showed us that there was a desire to expand Medicaid after Governor Kemp's essentially official first year of Georgia Pathways with such a big bust.
There was a bill to approve expansion under consideration, but it was blocked by Republicans who say they want to give Kemp's Pathways plan a chance to work. Ernst says the stakes are enormous.
I've talked with Georgians who have died because they couldn't get Medicaid until after they had stage 4 cancer and it was too late to keep them alive. I've talked to Georgians who lost their jobs because they couldn't stay healthy and become homeless.
And the need has only grown over the past year. During the pandemic, emergency regulations stopped states from removing people from Medicaid coverage. When that rule expired, states began reevaluating individuals' cases. If they didn't respond to letters or made mistakes with paperwork, they lost coverage. Hundreds of thousands of Georgians have been affected.
One place where the importance of Medicaid is clear is at the Family Health Centers of Georgia Clinic in Atlanta's West End neighborhood. We met someone who's been treating Medicaid patients for a long time.
I am Dr. Catherine Burley. I have been practicing internal medicine for 43 years.
In that time, she's seen what it means to have insurance and what it means to go without.
If you're a person who has diabetes, high blood pressure, that's the combination we see, and you don't have any insurance, then you're more likely to have that stroke, that heart attack.
But Dr. Burley sees a problem with the income limit for eligibility.
I would like to see a healthcare system that is not punitive. If you have Medicaid and you get a job, then you're making more money that automatically kicks you off Medicaid. But yet you may not be making enough money to afford commercial insurance. So it's like some people won't go to work because they don't want to lose their Medicaid. My thing is, let them stay on Medicaid and gradually wean them off instead of just cut them off.
Changing that all-or-nothing approach is exactly the type of reform that Atlanta Philharmonic conductor Amy Wilson told us she wants to see. But beyond all that, as someone still suffering from cancer, she just wishes she didn't have to think about any of this.
I feel like access to good, affordable health care should be a human right. No one should be suffering because they can't afford to pay, or they make $30 over the income limit, or because we didn't expand Medicaid.
Biden and Trump have vastly different visions for healthcare in the United States. Considering that Georgia is one of the swing states that will determine the election, how Wilson and other voters like her feel could play a big part in which vision America will choose in November. Tune in tomorrow to Morning Edition for the next story in our We the Voters series on healthcare as we hear just how difficult it can be to access care at all. This is NPR News.
And thank you for accessing and listening to KQED on Monday morning at 7:19. I'm Dave Freeman. Let us listen to Mel Baker for a traffic update as we head out to the East Bay, and it's around Hayward, apparently.
Yes, 880 southbound before Tennyson Road. The left lane is blocked by a five-car crash. Traffic is stop and go to 238. 880 southbound before 238, another two-car crash, but that one's been moved to the shoulder. And in San Jose, 880 northbound after Coleman Avenue, a cable or some other debris is blocking the second lane from the left. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Berkeley Repertory Theater, presenting Galileo, a new rock musical starring Raul Esparza as the rebel astronomer from the minds behind Spring Awakening and TV's Empire, playing through June 16th, berkeleyrep.org. Super Micro and NVIDIA accelerating AI with a wide range of AI servers and the NVIDIA AI Enterprise software platform. Supermicro is committed to driving AI infrastructure breakthroughs with rack-scale innovations. On Morning Edition coming up, one of the stories ahead this hour, why are teenage boys spending hundreds of dollars on cologne? The answer lies with fragrance influencers. We'll have that story and more coming up. Stay tuned later today for Forum at 9 on KQED. During the 9 o'clock hour, a new book considers the promise and peril of medicinal psychedelics. We'll have that discussion with the author at 9, then at 10.
I'm Mina Kim. Next time on Forum at 10 a.m., former White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki joins us to share the communication strategies and methods she learned in her rise to the most powerful communications role in the nation. Psaki says these strategies are applicable whether you're speaking to voters, the president, or a preschooler. Her new book is Say More. Join us, Forum, 10 a.m. on KQED.
Support for NPR this morning comes from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. BritBox, dedicated to helping people discover a world of British TV, including new original crime thriller After the Flood from the producers of Happy Valley, streaming at BritBox.com/NPR. And USPS, dedicated to providing businesses with shipping options, working to help businesses turn shipping into an advantage with USPS Ground Advantage. Learn more at usps.com/advantage. And the listeners and sustainers of KQED. Cloudy around the Bay Area today for the most part. Look for highs in the mid-60s, in the upper 80s today.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The Atlantic hurricane season is here. Climate change and warm oceans have led forecasters to predict one of the most active seasons on record, which means extra work for the Air Force Weather Reconnaissance Unit, known as the Hurricane Hunters. NPR's Debbie Elliott met some of them.
Six airmen are gathered around a conference table at Keesler Air Force Base in Biloxi, Mississippi, looking at conditions for the day.
We are TL-97 today, weather line. We're on 00, spot 15.
First Lieutenant Zach McDermott, the pilot, is briefing the crew before a Hurricane Hunter training flight over the Gulf of Mexico.
I was thinking at some point today we run through the invest checklist. Get ready, since storm season's a week away.
The 53rd Weather Reconnaissance Squadron is the only U.S. military unit tasked to collect real-time information for hurricane forecasters. They fly over, around, and through dangerous storms, piercing the eye wall as the propeller aircraft are pelted at times by hail and winds topping 150 miles an hour.
There's the cliche, it's like a roller coaster in a car wash.
That's Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Burton, Deputy Operations Commander with the Hurricane Hunters. He says the squad's roots date back to 1943.
It was a barbette. They were in Corpus Christi. I said, but you can't get fly through that hurricane out there.
So a pilot took the bet, and the Hurricane Hunters were born.
About 115 miles south of Mobile over the Gulf right now.
Hurricane Hunters fly C-130 Super Hercules, basically a military cargo plane fitted with weather equipment and the ability to deploy instruments including weather buoys and something called a drop sonde.
8 pound of weather. Yep. You're still good to drop at 8. You're clear on the left, clear on the right. On your call, weather. All right, Luke, you can go release sonde now. Sonde away.
Staff Sergeant Donnie Arsenault, the loadmaster on the flight, deployed the drop sonde through the belly of the plane. It's a compact weather station that looks like a paper towel roll with a tiny parachute attached.
Every quarter second, we get a tick of data back. That data consists of the temperature, humidity, and GPS location. Using the GPS location, we can track where it moves in the hurricane.
It measures wind speed and direction and atmospheric pressure. First Lieutenant Mark McCoy, the weather officer on board, sends the readings within 10 seconds to the National Hurricane Center so forecasters can better predict a storm's threats ahead of landfall.
All that most up-to-date information on what's going on in the storm system is critical for them to be able to find out how to forecast where the hurricane's going, is it intensifying or is it weakening.
Information used to determine what communities to evacuate and when, and where to stage emergency crews and relief supplies.
I think of this as a combat mission. We are protecting our coastline from these storms.
Colonel William McGee is the maintenance group commander who oversees the mechanics who keep the Hurricane Hunter fleet up and running, a tall task given they have the same 10 planes assigned to the group back in 1996. Since, their mission has expanded. They track tropical systems in the Atlantic and Pacific. Then a few years ago, they were tasked with a winter season, flying in northeast storms and the atmospheric rivers that hit the West Coast.
In years past, that was the time in which we recovered. We recovered our airplanes, we came home and saw our families, but now, instead of flying about half the year, we fly about 10 months out of the year. And so we're in a deployed status almost all the time. That's wear and tear on this unit.
McGee says since 2018, they've seen a six-fold increase in demand for winter reconnaissance missions and a 20% uptick in tropical flights. Yet the Hurricane Hunters are working with the same number of planes and crew. That means tough choices. For instance, at one point last year, there were two hurricanes, but they could only fly into one, McGee says, while they waited on repair parts. Hurricane Hunter commanders are making their case to Congress that they need additional resources. That's welcome news to the crew on this training flight. Pilot Zach McDermott says there's a cumulative impact from responding to everything they're tasked to cover when Mother Nature doesn't let up.
There's no downtime and there's not an extensive amount of time for training like we did tonight because we're constantly flying these tasked missions. more people and more airplanes could help, you know, spread out that workload that we have.
The Hurricane Hunters are unique, says Commander McGee, and need some relief.
There's a lot of combat units out there. There's one Hurricane Hunter unit, and we're it. And so if not us, then who? Well, there is no one else.
A mission McGee says they take seriously because lives are saved with more accurate hurricane forecasts. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Biloxi, Mississippi.
If you live with a teenage boy and your home smells like a Macy's beauty counter, you can probably thank TikTok. That's because fragrance influencers are all over social media.
Good day, guys. Jeremy Fragrance here.
Hey, guys. That Fragrance Kid here.
Hi, guys. It's the Colombo.
Jeremy Fragrance, the Fragrance Kid. Just some of the influencers who review scents online. Makes sense. The Cologne boy's real name is Jonathan Arora. He's an 18-year-old high school senior in Canada who films himself in front of his vast collection of designer colognes.
This is a very nice blue aquatic fragrance with that nice sweet tone to it.
The Cologne boy has 1.3 million followers on TikTok, and some of his videos include his mom.
Is this $1,000?
Yeah. No.
Just talking about this stuff, I feel like I'm smelling it here in Studio 31. The step goes well beyond Axe body spray. The cologne teenage boys are buying now can run hundreds of dollars per bottle.
A survey this spring by investment bank Piper Sandler shows that teen spending on fragrances shot up more than 20% over last year. So what explains the trend?
It really starts from social media and like just how impactful social media is on young minds.
Dr. Kim Alexander is a clinical psychologist at the Child Mind Institute and says wearing cologne can help kids feel a little more grown up.
We all can recognize moments in our youth where we really longed for adulthood or really longed for that agency and autonomy.
So spritz on, guys. Don't bathe in it, though. Remember, a little goes a long way.
That's a nice scent, Mr. Martinez.
This is NPR News.
Let's get a traffic rundown starting with the Altamont Pass now at 729.
We still have a crash in the eastbound direction of 580 before Grant Line Road. The three left lanes are blocked. This would be a major problem if it was in the primary commute direction. Nonetheless, traffic is slow back to North Flynn Road. Stop-and-go traffic through the Altamont Pass starting on 205 westbound from about Magley Road to 580, and then on 580 as you head past there to North Flynn. Crow Canyon Road northbound just after East Castro Valley Boulevard still closed by a trailer that overturned during a wrong-way collision with another vehicle. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED comes from Brevo. Growing businesses can choose Brevo as their marketing platform to help cultivate lasting customer relationships. More at brevo.com, brevo.com. And TheaterWorks Silicon Valley presenting Being Alive, a Sondheim celebration, a world premiere tribute to the composer of Into the Woods, Sweeney Todd, Company, and more. June 5th through the 30th in Mountain View, theaterworks.org. It's 7:30.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. California's largest wildfire of the year ignited over the weekend on the east edge of the Bay Area. The Corral Fire near Tracy started Saturday afternoon amid strong winds. By that night, it had pushed people from their homes and injured two firefighters. Since then, though, the situation has eased. State fire officials announced moments ago the fire, which has burned 14,000 acres in at least one home, is now 75% contained. All of that region's evacuation orders have been downgraded to warnings, and Interstate 580, which had been closed in the area, reopened. KQED's Catherine Monahan reports from Tracy.
Travis Curtis is sitting in a gas station parking lot with other evacuees. It's the last stop before a roadblock, and on the other side is whatever remains of his parents' house.
We're waiting to get the clearance to be able to go in and, you know, basically rip off the Band-Aid and see how bad it is. But from what we've been told, there's the foundation, and that is it.
Police ordered over 200 households to evacuate Saturday. Curtis says his parents left with only their tortoise, two dogs, and a bag of clothes. They're hoping their insurance can arrange housing for them while they decide whether to rebuild. In Tracy, I'm Catherine Monahan, KQED News.
About 1,400 Bay Area students are hoping for another opportunity to take the SAT. That's after a Wi-Fi problem at their testing site in Oakland prevented them from completing the exam on Saturday. Livermore High junior Emily Wagner says she started a petition to hold a makeup test at her school.
It's really important for me to be able to open up a new spot to take the test because a lot of students can't afford to travel hundreds of miles away to take the test somewhere else.
In a statement, the College Board, which runs the test, says demand is exceeding capacity for tests in the Bay Area. The College Board says students will receive a full refund, and they're working to ensure that students can take the test again. San Francisco supervisors are set to consider new rules today that would make it easier for the city to crack down on illegal street vending. KQED's Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman reports.
If a vendor is unlicensed or they can't show a receipt for the items they're selling, city staff can order them to stop what they're doing and leave. But Supervisor Asha Safai says this current enforcement, aimed at stopping the sale of stolen goods, isn't working.
There's a lot of cat and mouse that's been going on. People get a warning, they pack up, they move, they come back the next day, process starts all over again.
Under proposed legislation from Safai, illegal vendors would get a verbal warning. Then, if they're seen selling again within the next 120 days, city staff could confiscate their goods immediately. He's also proposing to ban some vending in areas zoned residential. I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. There's more news at KQED.org.
Monday morning support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com.
On the next California Report, school board members across the state are facing recall elections after receiving backlash for enacting trans notification policies and restricting the use of certain flags on campuses. I'm Maddie Bolaños. More on that next time on the California Report.
Hear more with Monty reporting from San Francisco coming up next hour, 8:51 a.m. on member-supported KQED, where support for NPR comes from Schwab, with Schwab investing themes like artificial intelligence, renewable energy, or pet passion. Over 40 themes to invest in. Learn more at schwab.com. Easy Cater, committed to helping companies solve food from employee meal plans to on-site staffing with corporate accounts, nationwide restaurant coverage, and payment by invoice. EasyCater.com. And by the listeners and sustaining members of KQED Public Radio. I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning on Monday, right now 7:35.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. The U.S. is putting new pressure on Hamas and Israel to permanently end the war in Gaza.
Yeah, President Biden surprised Israeli leaders last Friday when he went public with a ceasefire proposal that Israel had offered privately.
This is truly a decisive moment. Israel has made their proposal. Hamas says it wants a ceasefire. This deal is an opportunity to prove whether they really mean it.
Biden's speech set off debate inside Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet, which raises the question as to whether Israel can deliver on its own ceasefire deal.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is in Tel Aviv. Daniel, what does this ceasefire proposal say?
Well, it's a proposal for a six-week initial ceasefire, which would include a major hostage-prisoner exchange, and it would allow Palestinians to return to North Gaza for the first time in the war. Then it would be followed with a next phase, a final release of hostages, including male Israeli soldiers, and Israeli forces would withdraw from Gaza, and it would be a permanent end of hostilities. And then there would be a final phase after that, a big reconstruction effort for rebuilding Gaza's decimated infrastructure. This is a very similar proposal to what has been proposed for many months now, but that really never went anywhere. And so President Biden is making an effort for a breakthrough here. And he said, quote, it's time for this war to end.
Okay, now are Hamas and Israel on board with this framework to end the war?
Hamas says it is. It says it's ready to deal with the proposal positively and constructively. You know, President Biden is promising Hamas what it essentially has been asking for all along, which is a guaranteed and permanent end of the war. And our producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, has spoken to residents in Gaza who are eager to see President Biden push this deal through. The bigger question, A, is, if Israel is ready to get on board. Biden has packaged this as a ceasefire that Israel is backing, when in reality there is major disagreement about this in Israel. Public opinion-wise, there is a new survey that found 40% of Israelis polled do support the ceasefire deal. If you look at the military, you see that Israel's army is actually focusing new attention elsewhere in addition to Gaza. It's focusing on the Lebanon border and training troops there because there's been an escalation of Hezbollah fire onto Israel. The problem here with this deal is political. On the one hand, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has endorsed this plan privately. That's what an Israeli official tells me. But Netanyahu cannot come out and say it outright because the far-right flank in his government is threatening to resign over this proposal because they say it would keep Hamas intact. And if the far-right does resign, Netanyahu simply won't have a government anymore, and that could spell the end of his political career.
So if Netanyahu is in this bind, how is it likely to play out?
Well, Netanyahu, you know, does have an important choice to make. Ending the war could cost him his own political survival. At the moment, Israel's government politicians are holding consultations. They're making their own calculations about whether to embrace this deal. And Secretary of State Antony Blinken has spoken with Netanyahu's two other war cabinet members to try to push it through. Biden is making the case here that accepting the deal will bring a reward for Israel, which is diplomatic ties with Saudi Arabia, something Israel has long sought. And Biden is saying that that can help Israel become less isolated globally over its actions in Gaza.
All right, that's NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Daniel, thanks.
You're welcome.
Here in the United States, we are watching the aftermath of a criminal conviction. A jury of his peers said former President Trump was guilty on all 34 counts in his trial for falsifying business records. And as heard on this program on Friday, the ex-president made various claims about the trial.
We're going to be appealing this scam. We're going to be appealing it on many different things. He wouldn't allow us to have witnesses. He wouldn't allow us to talk. He wouldn't allow us to do anything. The judge was a tyrant.
For the record, the judge did allow defense witnesses, but limited the allowable testimony of one witness who never took the stand. Other witnesses did, and the defense made its case before losing. NPR's Andrea Bernstein has been covering the trial and the aftermath and is with us once again. Andrea, good morning.
Good morning.
What is Trump's legal team doing about the appeal that he mentioned?
So after the jury came back with the decision last week, the defense moved to set aside the verdict based on what it called Michael Cohen's lies on the stand. Judge Mershon said firmly, that motion is denied, but they can file more post-trial motions. Judge Mershon gave them a deadline of June 13th, Thursday of next week, and prosecutors have 2 weeks after that to respond. That day, June 27th, is the day of the first presidential debate.
Wow.
Meantime, the New York Probation Department will get to work on Trump's pre-sentencing report. Usually that involves an interview of the defendant by a probation officer. The New York court's website says, quote, the pre-sentence interview is a chance for the defendant to make a good impression and explain why he or she deserves a lighter punishment.
Okay, you said usually, so we don't know if that happens here. And we've heard differing opinions about whether Trump could truly get jail time when we get to the sentencing, which is in July. What are the factors for the judge to consider?
So on the one hand, Trump is a first-time offender and was convicted of an E felony, which is the lowest level felony in New York. And Judge Mershon signaled during summations that while sentencing is entirely in his hands, it could involve no incarceration. Judge Mershon has been vocal in all of his rulings. He understands his actions are taking place in the context of a presidential campaign and that Trump has First Amendment rights. On the other hand, among the factors that judges take into account are remorse and an otherwise clean record.
Okay, Trump has definitely not shown remorse or admitted that he did anything wrong.
In fact, he's shown the opposite of remorse. And he has three other indictments for dozens of felonies in other jurisdictions. He was recently ordered to pay in New York hundreds of millions of dollars in a civil fraud trial and another $90 million to writer E. Jean Carroll after civil findings he was liable for sexual abuse and defamation. And his company was found guilty in 2022 of 17 counts of felony fraud in the same courtroom in front of the same judge, Juan Mershon.
Okay, so assuming that he files the appeal, as he says he will, after sentencing July 11th, how's that go?
It could take years. Some legal analysts see very few grounds because of Mershon's care to eliminate inflammatory evidence and his relatively frequent rulings for the defense. And the New York law under which Trump was convicted, falsifying business records, is relatively common. But doing so to influence an election is not common. So Trump's lawyers may lean into that. As with so much else, we're in uncharted waters, and we will just have to wait and see.
Uncharted waters, and our navigator is NPR's Andrea Bernstein. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
This is NPR News.
Right here on KQED. Let us navigate now to the North Bay and find out about traffic in Petaluma.
Southbound on 101, just north of the county line down to Atherton. That's stop and go. Pretty usual traffic pattern. Slowing down on 101 southbound between Highway 37 and Central San Rafael in the Novato area. And it is definitely standard Monday traffic, 37 westbound on Vallejo between Wilson and the lane merge. Basically, you're just moving through a crawl through there. Then it's actually quite sluggish out to the Sonoma Raceway. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from UCSF Health. To love San Francisco is not to only embrace its diversity, but celebrate it. That's why UCSF Health provides care designed for the unique needs of each patient. To learn more, visit ucsfhealth.org/withlove. Xfinity offering wall-to-wall Wi-Fi coverage throughout the house with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary. Coming up on Morning Edition, a historic moment as Mexico elects its first female president. The details in just a few moments.
I'm Tiziana Deering. Families struggling to put food on the table often rely on school lunch programs to help fill the gap. And that makes summers, when most kids are out of school, particularly difficult.
I hear a lot about how summers are some of the hardest times of year for families when it comes to their food budgets.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Coming up after Forum Today, 11 to 1 on listener-supported KQED. All things considered at 1 today.
After author Michael Crichton died in 2008, his wife Sherry came across an unfinished novel.
It was just a big mystery. It's like, where is the rest?
Then James Patterson finished it.
Just an incredible challenge for me because Michael writes with a lot of science and I don't. So that was a very cool thing.
I'm Ari Shapiro, a collaboration from Beyond the Grave on All Things Considered from NPR News.
In Gaza, the violence of war is especially tough on young people. This teenager's whole family was in a house when it was hit.
A wall full of blood, shrapnels, and I couldn't recognize who's alive and who's dead.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Our series next week focuses on kids who've escaped Gaza. That's on the world.
That series, of course, starts today through the week at 2 on member-supported KQED, where support for NPR comes from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. Bank of America offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. And by the listeners, members, and sustaining members of KQED Public Radio. Morning Edition continues at 7:46.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Okay, here's the sound of history being made in Mexico City.
Por primera vez en 200 años, las mujeres lleguemos a la presidencia de la República.
Presidential candidate Claudia Sheinbaum says women have reached the presidency of the Mexican Republic for the first time in 200 years. She said las mujeres got there. Women, plural. Now that election results show that Sheinbaum herself is heading for a landslide victory.
NPR's Eder Peralta joins us now from Mexico City. Eder, Sheinbaum has been the favorite for months, so the results aren't necessarily a surprise, but tell us what it was like. Describe that moment.
Well, look, the Electoral Commission took unusually long to announce its results, but just before midnight, the commissioners came on TV and said that according to preliminary results, Claudia Sheinbaum had achieved an irreversible lead. I was at the Zócalo, which is Mexico City's main square, where many of her supporters had gathered, and it was an emotional moment. There were little girls with their moms, older women with their adult daughters. And it's hard to overstate what this moment meant for them. It has been just over 70 years since women were allowed to vote here. And now they were welcoming a woman president-elect. Let me play you a little bit of what it sounded like.
And here at the Zócalo, it is being celebrated as a woman breaking the highest of glass ceilings. And all of this is happening in a country that is notoriously machista. And now, Claudia Sheinbaum Pardo, a 61-year-old environmental engineer, a former mayor of Mexico City, she will become the first woman to hold the most powerful office in this country.
Sounds like a party, Ader. So what about the women at the square? What did they tell you?
You know, I saw women cry. I saw women dancing. I saw women hugging the Mexican flag and holding little dolls of Claudia Sheinbaum. I found 69-year-old Rosa Maria Garcia just staring at the presidential palace in front of her. And she told me that she has always felt that like this was a dream because she felt the power structures in Mexico had been in place too long and she thought that maybe Mexicans could never break free of them. But today, she says, they did.
Estoy muy emocionada, realizada, ver a una compañera que va a llevar las riendas del pueblo mexicano.
I'm emotional, she says. I feel complete seeing that a fellow woman will be in charge of the Mexican people. And, you know, before today, I had heard skepticism. Many women had told me that having a woman in the presidency didn't necessarily mean that she would be a feminist or that their lives would improve. And today I heard none of that. I heard women who were proud of their country and who were simply enjoying the moment.
All right, so the inauguration would be in October. Tell us about Mexico's president-elect and her policies.
Claudia Sheinbaum is a protege of the current president of Mexico, so she has hewed very closely to his policies, and so she's very likely to retain or even expand the welfare state that has made President Andrés Manuel López Obrador very popular. But also, early results seem to show that Sheinbaum's party might have achieved a supermajority in Congress. And Sheinbaum and her party say that they want to amend the Constitution, to reform the judiciary, the Electoral Commission, and to put at least some police forces under military control. If this supermajority holds, we can safely say that President Sheinbaum will usher in huge changes to Mexico.
That's NPR's Eder Peralta in Mexico City. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Let's find out about traffic in San Francisco now with Mel.
Coming into the city on 101 northbound between Paul Avenue and the hospital curve is stop and go. Heading through the other side on the Bay Bridge, the backup now is only to the overcrossing, although there is some slowing on 80 westbound as you approach the bridge. I'm Mel Baker for KQED.
Coming up, your Marketplace Morning Report on this Monday morning. Ahead for you, there's been a growing demand for metals, and with the UN set to receive the first deep-sea mining applications this summer, how are manufacturers dealing with pressure to ethically source their raw materials? Also ahead, a look at some of the ways cities are adapting for the future of how we work and live. Coming up this morning, a visit to Detroit, where a long-abandoned train station has been brought back to life by the Ford Motor Company. All ahead in a minute.
I'm Danielle Venton, science reporter for KQED. A scientist trying to explain climate change has thought hard about which visuals to use. Maybe a tattoo would help?
Because I'd want to add a data point every couple of years, you know. So then I thought, well, maybe it'll go up my neck, and I don't know.
A walking tour at Crissy Field, focused on climate change. You can find that story at kqed.org.
Here's what's coming up tonight at 7 on Fresh Air.
When Stephen Sondheim's musical, Merrily We Roll Along, opened in 1981, it flopped. But the new Broadway revival is a hit with 7 Tony nominations. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director, Maria Friedman, who was a close friend of Sondheim's, and Jonathan Groff, who won a Tony for his role as King George III in Hamilton. Join us.
Good morning on Monday, now 7:51.
When clean technology means mining the bottom of the ocean.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, helping provide a smarter, easier way to get the supplies businesses need to thrive. Amazon Business, your partner for smart business buying.
I'm David Brancaccio in New York. General Motors has its annual shareholder meeting tomorrow. One item for discussion, whether the automaker should take a stand on the use of metals mined from the floor of the sea. Tesla faces the same question at its shareholder meeting later this month. Under the sea holds a lot of potential to extract metals needed for electric vehicles and the clean energy transition, but there are many unanswered environmental questions. Companies are under pressure from some shareholders to follow strict environment, social, and governance principles, that is to say ESG, Marketplace's Daniel Ackerman reports.
Car makers are facing more and more scrutiny about where the metals they use are coming from. Gerard Barron, CEO of the metals company, says he has one solution.
Here we are with an alternative supply, 1,000 miles from the nearest living human, 4,000 meters below sea.
His firm is looking to collect millions of tons of cobalt and nickel ore from the bottom of the Pacific Ocean, far from any rainforests or drinking water, and then sell that metal to car companies. But this type of extraction has never been done at commercial scale. Andy Whitmore with the nonprofit Deep Sea Mining Campaign says it could permanently damage ocean habitat.
Deep sea mining is an industry that has a large number of potential risks. Some of those are reputational risks.
Reputational risks that some car makers don't want to take on. BMW, Volvo, and Volkswagen have all said they won't use ocean mined metals. GM's board of directors says there's no need to take a stand because the company is not currently using those metals. I'm Daniel Ackerman for Marketplace.
The New York Stock Exchange right now is looking into trading circuit breakers set up to quell unusual volatility. These may have triggered erroneously by perhaps a technical glitch this morning, but they're checking. Trading in shares of Chipotle and Berkshire Hathaway were among those stopped for a time. The stock indicators are mixed. The Dow is down 172 points, 0.5%. The S&P is down 0.2%. The NASDAQ is up 0.3%. And shares of the retailer GameStop are up 33% as people with stock trading apps hit buy orders after seeing their guru, a meme stock guy named Keith Gill, posting a picture of a screen that appears to show he holds a huge position in the stock.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is currently looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who are interested in building a career and joining an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And by UKG. UKG is a partner that delivers HR, pay, time, and culture solutions designed to help build a great workplace for everyone. UKG, our purpose is people.
Now to cities adapting to how we will work and live. A catalyst for many of these changes was the pandemic and the rise of remote work, but many were also a long time in the making. In Detroit, this includes the shift toward electrification we were just exploring, as well as automation in the car and truck industry. In Detroit, this shift has meant evolving to attract new workers with new skills. Marketplace's Nova Safo begins our series today with a visit to a gleaming example of that evolution. Detroit's once scary and abandoned train station, which has been brought back to life by the Ford Motor Company as a new center for tech innovation.
Outside the towering Michigan Central Station, landscapers are putting the finishing touches on a lush green campus, adding rows of trees. Their foreman is Drew Buell.
I've been told by the architects that Ford wanted something that looked like it'd been here, so it didn't look like a new landscape. That's why everything is kind of a bigger scale and planted close.
A bigger scale, that's a theme for this station, restored to its original 1910s Beaux-Arts architectural grandeur, draped in limestone, adorned with marble floors, terrazzo walls, grand columns and arches, and detailed carvings. Its rebirth will be complete this Thursday with an official reopening party for the public.
And this space was men's waiting room.
So I mentioned that
Josh Syrafman is giving us a tour. He's CEO of a Ford subsidiary called Michigan Central. It will operate the station, turning it into what's hoped to be a high-tech mobility hub.
This space you're in, the Grand Hall, has to be one of the most glorious spaces literally anywhere in the country. You know, the building has so many stories.
Glorious now. From the 1980s until 5 years ago, the train station sat empty and deteriorating. Ford's subsidiary reportedly spent nearly $1 billion renovating it, hoping its history, beauty, and proximity to Detroit's big three automakers would entice high-tech startups to locate there.
The point of innovating, the point of breaking new ground, advancing new ideas, never disappeared. And I think the point of all this being where you are now at Michigan Central is to create a world-leading center point of that.
Directly across from the renovated train station, there's a proof of concept. Detroit's old book depository building, also abandoned for decades, also restored. It reopened last year and houses an incubator of about 100 high-tech mobility startups, such as ESPE. Its CEO is Ron Butler.
I'm a former Detroit firefighter, as well as a public school teacher.
Butler sits in an office surrounded by gadgets, tools, and prototypes.
It's intelligent thinking blankets.
Just not too intelligent, I hope.
Well, we do fold in some AI.
All right. Butler is showing a prototype blanket woven with glass fibers that can cover electric vehicles and detect failing batteries before they burst into flames.
There's no place like this. Anything we want to do, we build our own electronics boards here and test them. The specialty fire blanket was sewn downstairs.
That kind of synergy is crucial for so-called hard tech firms, which are focused on building physical things.
Our margins are always very slim. We're poor people basically trying to build things. And this place allows us to do that.
That's the big sell. There's more work to do. The campus is surrounded by a neighborhood still struggling to recover from decades of decline. The hope is that Michigan Central can be the anchor of a tech renaissance. In Detroit, I'm Novosafo for Marketplace.
We visit another Detroit landmark once considered a symbol of an era of renewal. It's the Renaissance Center, home to the headquarters of General Motors. But not for long, the company's announced it's moving to a new space. We'll take a look at lessons from that shift for Detroit and beyond tomorrow. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report.